Welcome to Outbeat Radio on KRCB Windsor Santa Rosa, a program that focuses on issues by, for, and about members of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, queer, and questioning communities. You can hear Outbeat Radio every Sunday night at 8 p.m.
This is Living Proof, and we're your hosts. I'm Dr. Diana Grayer, and next to me is my co-host and wife, Sheridan Gold. Tonight, our guests are Adrian Momi and Cassandra Langer, who have been friends for over 60 years. Cassandra Langer is the author of the book Erase Her, a memoir about her life, who at 14 years old was subjected to conversion therapy for 2 years in the 1950s.
Sandy earned her doctorate at New York University and became a certified USPAP art appraiser. She has taught art history and criticism at Florida International University and University of South Carolina. Hello, Cassandra.
Hi, gang. How are you both doing? And thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Adrian Momi is a professional artist who studied at the Art Institute of Chicago and at the University of Miami. After a 10-year break and raising her daughter, Adrian returned to art making, and it was then that she experienced the life-changing opportunity to travel to Florence, Italy, where she learned to make prints.
Hello, Adrian.
Hi, everybody. I'm still here.
And we're glad you're here.
We are really looking forward to speaking with you both in more detail and learning about your special relationship. But first, here's news and events with Outbeat member and our engineer, Greg Maraglia.
I'd love to change the world, but I don't know what to do.
This is Greg Maraglia with your Outbeat Radio News for the week of March 5th, 2023. The international organization Human Rights Watch has accused Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, Twitter, and Grindr of not doing enough to prevent violence against LGBTQ plus users by anti-LGBTQ plus officials on the continent of Africa and many countries in the Middle East. In a new report released by the Human Rights Watch, they interviewed 90 LGBTQ plus people who had been digitally targeted on various social media apps by officials in 5 countries, including Egypt, Iraq, Jordan, Lebanon, and Tunisia. The Human Rights Watch also interviewed 30 experts about anti-LGBTQ plus harassment in each of these countries. In countries where same-sex sexual activity is outlawed, law enforcement frequently forces men accused of being gay to undergo invasive and degrading forced anal examinations. According to the report, quote, authorities across the 5 countries manually monitor social media, create fake profiles to impersonate LGBTQ people, and entrap them on dating applications such as Grindr and social media platforms such as Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and WhatsApp. Authorities sometimes publish LGBTQ plus people's personal information on social media, leaving them subject to family violence or homelessness. Other authorities meet with LGBTQ plus people in public, detaining them and then unlawfully searching their personal devices, often under the threat of violence. Using these devices, the authorities collect or create private information that will enable them to prosecute a detainee and their suspected LGBTQ plus associate. One 23-year-old Egyptian man named Ayman said that he agreed to meet a Grindr connection at a cafe, but instead 5 plainclothes police officers met him and threatened to hang him with a rope if he didn't open his phone. While most of the arrestees are acquitted in court, many were jailed, often for prolonged periods of several months. Those found guilty in court served 1 to 3 years in prison. Authorities and gang members do all of this with impunity, and victims are reluctant to report these activities over fear they'll face anti-LGBTQ plus harassment as a result. And here in the U.S., a former NFL player was arrested last Tuesday morning after allegedly assaulting his son and his son's boyfriend outside of their Indiana home. According to NBC News, the police responded to a delayed domestic disturbance at the home of retired Indianapolis Colts lineman and former radio host Joe Stasniak. Just before midnight on Monday, after a young man called police saying Stasniak had attacked him earlier that night, Stasniak was arrested and charged with a felony count of strangulation and 2 misdemeanor counts of battery. According to station WTHR, Stasniak said he received a call from his neighbor about a suspicious car parked in front of his yard. Stasniak reportedly admitted to approaching the car with a gun. after finding his 18-year-old son and the son's boyfriend in the car, according to a probable cause affidavit. Stasniak opened the rear passenger door and grabbed the boyfriend's hood and choked him. Stasniak's son said the father punched him, causing his lip to bleed, and then punched his boyfriend. The boyfriend told police that Stasniak flashed a gun and held it against the boyfriend's face. Stasniak reportedly told the two young men that they were, quote, lucky he saw who it was, end quote. Stasniak was released on Tuesday after he made an initial court appearance via video that same day. And according to new polling from Gallup, a survey found that over 7% of adults in the U.S. identify as LGBTQ+. That's double what Gallup found when it first measured LGBTQ+ identification 10 years ago. Gallup surveyed more than 10,000 adults across the U.S. in 2022, asking each respondent if they identified as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or something else. Over half of those surveyed and identified as LGBTQ+, identified as bisexual, 4.2%. The poll found that 20% of LGBTQ+ adults said that they were gay, 13.4% said they were lesbian, and almost 60% identified as bisexual. Almost 9% say they identified as transgender. And as you might guess, generationally, Gen Z identified as LGBTQ+ the most, 19.7%. Jeff Jones, a senior editor with Gallup, said that since Gallup has been tracking LGBTQ+ identities, the only notable difference seen over time is how certain generations identified, and this came mostly from millennials. The Gallup poll comes as state legislatures across the country target LGBTQ+ rights. There are currently 340 anti-LGBTQ+ bills that the Human Rights Campaign is tracking. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moralia.
If you just joined us, we are talking with Cassandra Langer and Adrian Momi. We want to thank you both so much for giving us a little bit of your time from your very busy schedules.
Yes.
Oh, our pleasure.
I am so excited to learn about you both. I know the listeners are as well. So let's begin, because there's so much history with you two. I would like to, it's over 60 years. So I would like to, let's start with sharing more about your relationship. Okay, Adrian, go ahead.
Yeah, I think it must have been the very first week of our first year of, at the University of Miami. And I was leaving the art department, which was a collection of shacky buildings down at the terrible end of the college campus. And I was walking up towards the other buildings, and there was Sandy standing there holding a briefcase. Looking amazing. and I was just blown away. I was stopped in my tracks, and I knew right then and there that this was the person that had to be in my life. And it was wonderful. It's been wonderful ever since then to be her friend, to be her sharing our lives together and going through all the vicissitudes that one does in all these very long years.
Yes, absolutely. And what I liked about her was her smart brain and her smart mouth, particularly in class,
which also one.
You know, we were very opinionated young women, very quick to read people in that sense. We were in this awful class. You remember that professor who was the awful misogynist who was pontificating away, just a bag of hot air. And she turned to me sotto voce and made some comment, and I could hardly keep from peeing my pants because of it in the class. And I knew we were meant for each other.
You mean that guy who insisted on calling Don Quixote Don Quixote?
Right. That's the one. Oh, God. Yeah. And then we would get out of classes and decide to go over to Coconut Grove and debrief on all of our classes in a convivial setting. Usually either the drugstore or the other place, that little plaza place that the guy who set up Victoria's Secrets.
You mean the country store?
No, not the country store, that other place where we used to have breakfast and everybody from U of M used to gather there.
Yeah.
So anyway, it was convivial, and we had some classes we liked, like on aesthetics. You had a crush on that guy, Painter.
Oh, Painter?
Yeah, I think that was his last name. Was it Jack Painter or something? Anyway, so we bonded around that as well as the studio practices and the teachers we had, which were kind of an interesting bunch of mainly macho guys, would you say?
Well, it was an interesting time in the world because things were changing rapidly. You know, we were evolving from being kind of babes in the woods to go through the beatnik period. This was the time when Alan, what's his name? My senior moment here, Howell, who was the author, the guy from San Francisco, you know, and there was a thriving art scene in Coconut Grove, and people were, it was pre-hippie, but it was post-beatnik. So, you know, people were exploring their creativity in various ways. And, you know, so we were kind of lucky to be at the cusp of all that when all those changes were happening. And of course, we were part of it. And I'd like to think that in some ways, we eventually drove it, because we really did take away from that period of time, post-abstract expressionism painting, combining it with traditional work. And I think that we really made a difference, I hope, in some way in the art world in that way.
Well, I think we did. I think because we were at the cusp of the folk music aspect of it, because Pete Seeger's mother lived in Miami, and they all used to come down. And then Alex Dobkin, before she was a lesbian, when she was married to Sam, ran a coffee house in a beatnik place that we used to go to listen to music. So everybody came to Miami. People don't really know the history that well, but it was a thriving scene with people coming from New York and people coming from California. And we got to meet Mama Cass and Odetta, and you name them. We got to meet them and make out with them and smoke grass with them and, you know, on Fair Isle and all of that. So it was a pretty exciting time for us as young art students, you know, dealing with the whole macho notion of the you paint with your penis, which of course was impossible, you know, for us. However, we had aspirations somewhat different than that at the time. So it was a freeing moment if you were a thinking woman who wasn't planning, as your mother would want you to just get married off and be secure at that time.
You've mentioned at that time and during those times, and I'm curious, what years are you speaking about?
This is the late 50s, early 60s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would be like 58, 59 through, you know, the 60s.
Mm-hmm. Early 60s. Yeah, through 63. That was when I left.
It sounds wonderful that you two met each other and you both were outspoken women, you know, like you're these feisty two.
We've always been that way, and you know, and that's a gift and that's a curse.
Yeah, well,
yes. Say more.
Well, because when one has ideas, and you know, and this world really hasn't changed all that much in terms of honoring what women have to contribute to the world, and you know, we've been called names.
So.
That we probably shouldn't mention on the radio, because we really don't hold back, because there's no way that we're going to affect any change in the world if we hide in any way, and you know, and our opinions are valid, and we know our opinions are valid regardless of whether people agree with us or not, and very often the disagreement is what produces the best effect in the world. You know, having a good healthy argument can really settle things. Not that I choose to make arguments for that purpose, but I don't hold back. You know, if I disagree with somebody and they're open to a conversation, I'll engage. And Sandy always has done that too. And sometimes we do it together.
and to each other.
Just because we've got this wonderful love between us, it doesn't mean that we always agree with one another. And I think that's healthy.
Yeah, it's very healthy. And I mean, very often, Adrian will say to me, well, you put your foot in it this time, didn't you? You know, I'll have to say, well, maybe, maybe not. Let's see. And then I usually have to come back and say, well, you know, maybe you were right after all.
And vice versa. You know, and vice versa, you know, because I certainly haven't lived a sainted life either. So.
Yeah, and it's an interesting relationship because people have failed to understand and misinterpreted our relationship. Adrian is, you know, for all intents and purposes, somebody who I always refer to as hopelessly heterosexual. And I'm hopelessly gay, and there's just no two ways. But we, as far as relationship goes, aside from sex, might as well be soulmates, lovers, whatever, because that's what we are. We never desert each other. We're always loyal. We're always truthful. And we're always there for each other.
And in fact, now that we're in our 80s, it's terrifying. For me, to think that one of us is going to be without the other.
Well, you're not allowed anyway. We've decided, we're going to go simultaneously.
That's hardly likely. But, you know, in so many ways, Sandy has been the only love of my life. She's been the only person I've been able to depend on.
I feel the same about Adrian. Every time I've had a crisis with my various lovers, she's been there and had my back no matter, and able to clarify things or the crisis, like with this crazy book baby, you know, self-publishing thing, which is my first one. It's a nightmare, to say the least, with them screwing up the document. But aside from that, I mean, you know, I always can count on her, no matter. It can be 3 o'clock in the morning, it can be whatever. And you don't have many friends like that. I don't care what your orientation is.
No, you don't have too many of those stories. But I love your story. It's beautiful. The friendship, the soulmate that you are.
Yeah, we are. We have been, despite our mothers.
Well, they certainly did their best.
To get
they did
in the
their
way.
Best to separate us and to drive us apart.
Yeah, in college?
Yeah, in college. Our mothers had some serious issues unresolved of their own, and they projected them on us in some way, and we suffered. Our relationship suffered as a result, you know.
Adrian's mother was convinced I was going to recruit her. Or groom her, or whatever they call it.
Oh, no, she actually thought it was contagious.
She thought, like a disease.
By hanging out with somebody who was woman oriented, it was contagious. I mean, she didn't see me as a strong person. She saw me as somebody that was easily influenced. And Sandy's mother thought that I was the fault. I was at fault. and that was why Sandy was misbehaving all the time.
Yeah, that was a large part of it. I mean, the whole orientation, I don't think younger people understand so much. Your job was to be groomed, to get married, preferably to somebody who could take care of you and had more money than your family.
And was chosen by your parents. But, you know, in many ways, it was a medieval system still in existence.
Yeah. Absolutely. And the social climbing that went along with it, with my mother, and your mother was horrendous about getting you married off.
Well, yeah, they were going to create in Yiddish, we call it a shidduch, you know, an arranged marriage. This was in 1962. I mean, who does that in those years? You know, it was, we were still considered to be pawns.
Yeah.
Coin in the family realm, you know,
right.
And the fact that neither of us, I had no interest in getting married. I wanted to get out of the house. So I would have agreed to get married just to get out of the house.
You know? All the way up. I did, and ended up in Quaker Ridge. Anything to get away from that crazy family.
Yeah. So, you know, so we just the fact that we were able to overcome the fact that our parents were so, well, actually, I don't think your dad was quite as bad as your mom. And my father was absent completely from the conversation. But, you know, the fact that we were able to persist with our caring for one another and caring about one another and literally caring for one another was quite a testimony to our strength of our relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. As I, you know, they make that saying about, I give you the shirt off my back. Well, I gave her the coat off my
back.
Gave
me the coat off her back.
You took off with the David.
Yeah.
So you took off with David. That means you found somebody.
No, I split.
You really wanted to be with.
No, what? I split. I was hanging out with a gang of musicians, and they were leaving town, and it was an opportunity for me to get out of Dodge. And I split. You know, they like to say I ran away, but running away means there's something that you need to that's there. Nothing was there. I just had to cut it off and get out. And there was Sandy with her red car coat that had those wooden buttons on it. I'll never forget that, because in Florida we didn't have warm clothes, and I was leaving town, and it was very dramatic.
Yeah, absolutely. I wrote a poem about it years
later. You have the poem?
Somewhere in my thing. I think I may have put it in the Rainbow Blues
book. It was in the Rainbow Blues book, yeah.
Yeah. A book of poetry.
Can you just tell us about the poem that you wrote?
Well, it was essentially about that episode when Adrian ran off with a famous, well, soon to be famous rock. Excuse me, but he was. He really was very immature. Cute, very cute. But, you know, it was an opportunity. I think, you know, if you read Allen Ginsberg's Howl and you realize the on the road kind of thing, which was fundamental for the boys, but also for many women who didn't want to conform at that time, whether they were sexually fluid or whatever, there was a sense of meeting life in the raw at that point and finding out what you were made of. And so Adrian was off and running. And then her mother, you know, put the pressure on me, and I managed to hold out for, what, 3 or 4 days before she finally, you know, managed to break me down. And I said, well, I don't know where she's going, but she went with, and she had detectives all over to find Adrian and bring her back into the fold. So
this was college age?
Yes. Yeah, you can't imagine the family dynamics that were in evidence then, and the thwartedness of our mothers, both of them, in a certain sense, that led them to do these kinds of things. You know,
it sounds very painful.
It was painful, but it made us grow. I think that's true, Adrian. It made us much stronger. I mean, if it doesn't kill you, you know, it makes you stronger.
Absolutely. You know, and literally the cat was out of the bag for me, as far as I was concerned.
Yeah.
You know, there was no way that I was ever going to believe that the family had any of my best interests at heart. And, you know, and so in a way it liberated me to continue to be who I was and only pretend to please them as it suited me to do.
Yeah, there's a lot of that chameleon stuff going on at that time, too. I don't think that, again, in the case of lesbians and gays, particularly in Miami, with what was going on with the Johns Committee and the purging of the universities and all of us and how we came together as outlaws, because that's, you know, you could be thrown into jail. You could simply, you know, be just dismissed as people. And the cops were terrible. particularly for lesbians at that time. I mean, if you were with somebody who was under 21 and you happened to be 21 or so, the cops would think nothing of intimidating you, making you give blowjobs and all kinds of stuff like that in order not to be, you know, hauled off to jail or be charged with whatever they called it, with minors. And so, and that was a big issue in coming out for me when I got back from the conversion therapy of finding my people, you know, on 21st Street Beach. It took listening to the straight girls giggling in the lockers as to where the queers were and so on to be able to find out where I needed to go.
And that lack of safety,
yeah,
for me was thing that kind of kept me in the closet, because I really was not interested in men, even though I, as Sandy will say, she thinks I'm a hopeless heterosexual. I hung out with guys because that was what the expectation was, you know, but the interest really wasn't there. And, you know, and the, for me, it was also a matter of safety to hide out.
Yeah, but in that. Everybody hid out. I mean, at that time, I used to have my hair in a French twist. I'd go out with my beards to protect them, and all of that social stuff, dressing up, makeup, you name it. We had to do it. There was just no other way to function in the world that we were living in. And it was difficult. And let's face it, Adrian, we were rebellious. I mean, we used to run around in your car and, you know,
that's true.
provoke all those straight guys. She had this Corvette, and we'd put the top down, and the two of us would go tooling along. And then these guys, because of the car, would want to, you know, kind of race with us. We always wiped them out, and it was such a pleasure to do so. It really was.
I see this movie of you two, sort of like that Thelma and Louise kind of thing. Yeah. You two riding in your Corvette, you know, how beautiful. And as you're talking, I'm just thinking about the situations with your families, your mom, your parents. Did you have siblings? Did you have no other family support? And if you didn't, I mean, how are you with your family throughout the years? Did they come around?
I'm totally estranged. My brother was jealous of me. He's 4 years younger, and, you know, a Jewish prince and all of that stuff. And he was always jealous and petty, and continues to be. And so I don't have a relationship with them for a number of reasons, which I won't even go into, that required a lawyer. And they're all lawyers in my family. So this was very expensive for me to push back and get my autonomy in my 60s. Took that long to separate out financially and everything else. I mean, my brother once said to me after my father died, "There's nothing here for you," and he really meant it. And then when my mother was setting up a trust, and I had just had a hysterectomy, he made her put in blood relations. So I couldn't even adopt a child to leave money to if I had enough to leave. That's loving, brotherly, whatever. And then
he always was a snake.
Yeah, always.
Even as a little boy, he was a sneak. He used to like sneak and spy on us when we were hanging out at your house.
I know, terrible. He really was and is.
Yeah.
A nice guy, you know, family court judge, all of that. So nobody would know how bad he was in the family.
And, you know, and because I was pretty darn good at hiding who I was and what I was doing. So I was able to mostly maintain a relationship. My sister's much, much younger than I, so she really wasn't involved in any of this. She was just a little girl. She was only 4 years old when all of this was going on for me. And, you know, and to this day, my brother refers to me as his crazy sister. And not just jokingly, I'm sure. You know, he acts like it's joking. But, you know, so I've managed to continue to maintain a relationship because for me, it served to do it rather than not. And, you know, I'm just with regard to the family, it's, there's no, I preferred to have things be smooth rather than, even if I had to make some big, big changes, you know, and to make some big compromises in order to make that happen.
Absolutely.
We're just curious about your, how much you want to talk about your conversion, all of that experience as a child, and then move into the book.
Fine. The book was hard to do because, you know, I locked everything away for years and years and years. And it wasn't until Lila Akon, you know, committed suicide, and my ex-lover asked me to talk to her class at Yeshiva that I even thought of, you know, opening up that box and pulling all of this out. But it seemed to me, in talking to her class of potential clinical therapists who were going to be dealing with our community for sure, you know, and our youth, that they didn't know jack about any of this. And they were in a state of shock when I told them about shock treatments, hypnosis, you know, threats of lobotomy and so on. And I said, you know, kids, more or less, you know, that's the basis for everything that's now called conversion therapy and that the religious right is making a ton of money destroying people with. And so we talked about it a bit. And then I thought, you know, I'm the age I am now. If I don't do it, who the hell is going to fill in a secular history in order to let people know that just regular so-called psychology and psychiatry is doing many of these same things, and that the basis is all the way back in post-World War. I mean, they're ahistorical. They don't deal with history. And I think knowing the history of your oppression is particularly relevant now with what we're going through with the megas and the QAnons and their distortions and disinformation of everything. So we need a text that's real, a real story that people can get some hope from and some strength and some skills from. So that's basically why I wrote the book. God knows it wasn't to make money. It's costing me more than I ever thought just to do it. And the publishers that we generally go to all thought it was too small and it's a girl's story. So they weren't particularly interested because it wasn't a boy's story. And I'm only saying this to you on the radio, but that's the truth.
Yeah, it's interesting that in your book, you talk about life as a girl and how they tried to get you to do girl things. You can talk more about that, but you're still dealing with it now.
Oh, we're all dealing with it. Women haven't had the equal rights. You know, I'm a feminist first and foremost, I mean in that. And I write about how that happened at 5 or 6 in the book, because I think if you have intelligence and awareness and you've been assertive as a girl, which most girls are, basically it gets drummed out of you by conditioning, constant reinforcement of what you can and cannot do and what the expectations are. So it's, you know, hasn't changed all that much.
It's interesting though, to know that what you just said, and then to see some girls buy into it.
Yeah.
And other girls not buy into it. And where does that strength come from? The bending to everything and it's normal, and the refusal to bend, and the consistency, the perseverance of wanting to be your own person.
Yeah, right.
Well, not everybody should do that if they don't want to. I mean, first and foremost, feminism is about choice. It's not about women being strong. It's about giving women the chance to choose what they want to do. You know, so if a young woman wants to have a family and feel subservient to a man and that's her choice, fine. You know, she shouldn't be penalized for that. And on the other hand, a young woman doesn't want to do that and wants to follow a different path, she should be allowed to do that as well. You know, if it's about choice, it doesn't mean that you choose what's right or wrong. It's allowing the person to make the choice that's valid for them. And that was what we rebelled against, that we weren't being permitted to make the choices that were valid for us.
Well, we made those rules for ourselves, and we had the defiance frankly, of our family and our social structures to do that. But the strength, the authenticity issue comes out. You have to, how to put this, at 5 or 6, I knew certain things about myself. For instance, playing with all my boy cousins, I was the only girl in generations, and I was stronger, I was smarter, I could beat them all up to a certain point. And until that separation hit me like that, that because I was a girl, I was going to be denied the same educational opportunities in the Haider, you know, when the boys were separated out in our Jewish culture, but it's the same in all cultures, basically. Men predominate, boys get into what I call the bro program, you know, or toxic masculinity and all of that. And girls either say, oh, well, you know, that's the way it is. And okay, I'm okay with that. Or like me or Adrian, we say, wait a minute, there's something wrong with this picture. It's not fair and I'm not buying into it. So when you ask about that, I think that's a matter of personality. You know, you just come out and you are who you are, and the culture then begins to shape you and cut you up and turn you into what they want you to be, which is relentlessly heterosexual and binary.
You know, and I'm really proud of the kids nowadays. I have a granddaughter, and she's very much in the fluid sexuality. She's a they, them. I shouldn't say she. Teo, I'm too old. I'm just too old. Teo is a baby. And bravo for her. She chose to leave college because they thought that it wasn't serving. And I was 100% behind that. You know, and it was interesting that I would be able to take that stance, because when Teo's mother wanted to go to college, she's my daughter's 55 now. My father said to me, what's the point of sending a girl to college? This was in the 1980s. That's how medieval the family that I come from is. You know, and my experience of being allowed to go to college was not allowed to stay at the dorm. I had to commute from home. They had started giving me art lessons when I was 8 years old. They trotted me off. They saw I was talented. And then when I declared an art major at university, it was like, well, why would you do that? You know, why would you want to be an artist? You know, and if you're going to go to college, you have to do something that's going to earn you a living. Well, in those days, it meant being a nurse, it meant secretary, or it meant being a teacher. Well, I refused to learn how to type because I was never going to be a secretary. And I ended up teaching in college level many, many years later, but I certainly wasn't going to go to teaching school in the 1950s, early 60s, because it was their expectation. And, you know, and consequently, it was like my expectation of college was so different from the family's expectation. And I was lucky that they allowed me to go at all.
Yeah, you were, because that wasn't what your trajectory was. And then I got to know all those lesbians and gays like Meryl Mushroom. And well, she was Harris then, of course. And, you know, a whole little group of people, some of who lived on the beach, and we were able to support each other and falsify our birth certificates so we could go to the bars, because the bars were different in those days because of the outlaw status, and they tended to nurture the youth with Sunday potluck kind of brunches where they kind of guided us through the world we were going to have to be in and the world outside. So you had a sense of belonging and having found your people with these older gay people who'd been through hell, to say the least, and how the culture worked as an outsider culture and an outlaw culture at that time. Because, of course, you know, you get into the gay life, you wanted a girlfriend. Where were you going to find a girlfriend? I mean, on the beach, yeah, sure. But then, you know, as far as where were you going to take her and so on, some of the older gays opened up their homes. I had, in my case, I guess they would call them drag queens today, but actually they were female impersonators like Charlie Pierce and Jackie Jackson from the Jewel Box Review and stuff like that. So I was lucky in that sense for the horrible coming out I finally had to have with my parents, which is the next volume that I'm going to write to cover gay life and Anita Bryant, as well as the Joint Committee and Gene Leary and all of those people who came down to tell us how to run our lives.
What's the committee?
That was the John's Committee, which purged all of the college teachers at that time in Florida. And people committed suicide and people's careers were destroyed. Meryl Mushroom wrote a short piece about it. I think she has it logged into the Southern archives that the Southern women have been doing lately, because everything is bi-coastal and they ignore all of us who are anywhere else. And Miami wasn't what it is now. As Adrian and I, when we were growing up, everybody was saying, you know, 10 years from now, Miami will be, 10 years from now, it will be. Well, by the time we left, we got tired of hearing another decade and we went off, you know.
We used to call it the land of creeping mind rot.
Basket weaving in my run. It's true. And then, you know, we in my case, you learn to be a very competent liar and chameleon with your families. I got together with a friend of mine, gay male friend of mine, slightly older. We rented a small apartment and we pretended to be young marrieds. And then we used the apartment to be free in that sense, and cover for each other so that we could have that kind of freedom to bring a girlfriend or a boyfriend. And, you know, it had a little kitchen. That's that night you left. And we had that moment in the kitchen.
Survival in Miami.
Yeah, absolutely.
You have so much history, Sandy. You've got to get on those books, honey.
Yeah, well, that'll be the second volume if I ever get this first one straightened out with those idiots at Book Baby.
So, yeah, we want to hear about that, but I want to hear Adrian. Sandy talks a lot about her experience in the LGBTQ community. What were you doing? Did you have any?
I was busy trying to get out of Dodge, literally. You know, getting away from my parents and getting away from my very powerful family was uppermost in my mind, you know. So I married the first, I grabbed the first life raft I could find and married him, and moved to California, and got away from them, and they didn't like him, and it was a painful blessing because they shunned me for about 10 years. My family did not have anything to do with me. In, except to show up for when my daughter was born. And then that was to torture me over that, you know, and then nothing for the very longest time. And then I ended up divorcing that guy and having to move back to Miami because I had no place to go. I was in New York. I was broke. I had a little kid, you know, and then my mother gets back in the picture. Because the first person I connected with when I got back to Miami was Sandy. And then I was going through this awful divorce and my mother was making it even worse and carrying on that if I continue to be friends with Sandy, the courts would take away my daughter. And that she very well could have been right because people were so prejudiced there against us, you know, and at that time I was so battered and beaten emotionally that I had no room for any kind of physical relationship, you know, and Sandy was my great support during all of that time, you know, so got through that and then just decided, well, you know, I capitulate, I give up, you know, I can't fight them anymore. They were just overwhelming. And I grabbed the next life raft I could to get out of Miami and got married again. This time I was a little smarter and got somebody who had enough money to set me up, you know? So when I got rid of that marriage, much against my mother's will, I mean, of course, by that time, she was at the end of her life, so I didn't have to deal with her physically anymore. But still, the whole relationship that I had with Sandy all this time was what supported me and kept me going, because there was nobody else that I could count on. There really wasn't. And, in the meantime, I was doing all the survival tactics I could do. They weren't the best, but they were what they were. And, and then after I was able to get rid of that marriage, it was just, hallelujah, I don't have to do this anymore.
Well, it was finding yourself in a lot of ways in your art and getting out from under the thumb
It was complicated. It was because my family is very powerful. So it was more than just the issue of, having a parents that were difficult to deal with. There were other very real things in the world. And, it was about finding myself, and more important than finding myself, it was being able to stand up to those very powerful people. And I wasn't the only one in the family that was facing that issue. My first cousin, Fred, has also, I knew who he was. He knew who I was, but we were never able to talk to anybody in our family about that, now that they're all gone, we can be who we are. But, I would have liked to have been a braver person with regard to those things, but I did the best I could. And here I am. And that's why I say when we open up, I'm still here. And I'm very proud of being still here, because Sandy and I have each weathered horrendous maelstroms in our lives, different kinds, but here we are. We still are here, and we are thriving, and we are gracefully going into our 80s, knowing that we count for a lot.
That's beautiful. I love what you just said, Adrian. Say something about your art, and then we'll hear something more about your book, Sandy. So how is that art, your artistic world, have embraced you and made you who you are?
Well, for me, it's about process. I'm not about making product. So, so my entire career in art has been peripatetic. I do what I feel like doing when I feel like doing it. And then once I've solved the problem, I move on to something else, because it's a continual creative growth for me. I found something recently. I think one of my cousins found it in some book somewhere. I wrote my first art book when I was 7 years old. I wrote and illustrated a story. I think it was called The Princess and the Poor Girl. And somebody in the family thought it was really cute. Isn't that cute? Adrian makes all these pictures. So it's, for me, it's been an ongoing expression. And because I was so repressed in so many ways, that it was always the way that I could express myself was visually. And often my visual expressions are code. They're not literal, because when you're hiding who you are, you can't be literal in what you're drawing. I mean, I did draw pictures of girls that had things coming out of their heads. And my mother said, "What's that?" I said, "That's their brains." I knew from a very early age that I was really smart. So I've just had this very interesting career of going back and forth between academics and making visual art, and writing, and then writing and making art together, and showing and not showing, and people get it or they don't get it. And I really don't care, because I'm going to continue to do this for as long as I can. I'm leaving at the end of this month to go to Venice for another art residency. And I don't know what I'm going to do there. And I was talking to an artist friend of mine from Italy late last week. And she said, "Well, how do you want to be in Venice? They're so traditional." But, I always feel that I can learn something, even if it's not the way I want to do it. Nothing wrong with submerging yourself in the traditional ways. And you can't break the rules unless you know what the rules are. And so that's always been the way I work. So anyhow, it's a lot of hot air about nothing, I suppose.
Well, not true. darling. I mean, we met in art school. I still do art when I can, because I get tired of the verbal and I can't say what I want to say with words. So I, you know, do my paintings. I have a couple in the book, and it's just the way it's always been. The two poetry books that I published through Lulu, Rainbow Blues and Visages of Venus, which were a homage to a lover who no longer is here, and all of that. It's erotic lesbian poetry. And I wanted to make a statement in that book about how women love, basically, when they're involved. I mean, every man under the planet, Rilke, Gerson Keeler, you know, this one, then everybody loves it. But when a lesbian does it, it's another story entirely. So, you know, I wanted to be able to do that kind of thing and use both sides of, you know, my brain or whatever, the verbal, the visual, and make that exchange. But Adrian and I have always been pretty much on the same plane in terms of how we think about making art or being creative in that sense. It's never been about the money. It's never been about the commercial aspects. So we made livings teaching or in other ways. I mean, when I left my tenured position at South Carolina, because I couldn't stand it anymore after getting my Smithsonian, I went, you know, basically into a freelance thing, writing freelance criticism and everything else. And then when that petered out with the art world, basically, I went in and I took a appraisal degree so I could continue to pay for my pleasure of writing and painting. So I think you have to be resilient in that way. And you have to have self-confidence that, you know, you're following your own drummer, you know, And that's been real for both of us, to be authentic, to follow our own visions, regardless of whether they're popular in the culture and all the rest of it.
And to do the things that are important, regardless of how people feel about it. After I finished my, I was teaching at Pacifica Graduate Institute in mythological studies, and I was always, my field in scholarship is prehistoric work. I'm interested in pre-literate, you know, what how did people look at story before they could write it down? So I spent my time studying the Neolithic period. And I went to the Czech Republic, and I worked on an archaeological site there in trying to tease out what the stories could possibly have been, you know, asking those questions. And then I went to Turkey to do the same thing. And I was at a very famous site there called Çatalhöyük. So I'm there for 3 years working on this. And the question came up about, you know, why was I there? It was we were in a conference of all the archaeologists and me. I was the artist in residence. And here I am thinking I'm doing what I want to do, and I'm following my path. And the director of the site stands up and says, well, I didn't invite her. So, you know, so there I was, hung out to dry and still able to continue to do what I knew was the thing that was important for me to do, you know, and to continue to raise questions in spite of people not understanding, even the people I was working with never understood what I was doing. It really has been for both of us a lifetime of following our own drummers, getting hit and often being hit over the head with the chopsticks as we went, the drumsticks as we went along, but continuing, persisting.
Powerful. Sandy, please tell us about how proud you are of your book, Erase Her.
I'm very proud of it because going through the experience of re-experiencing it emotionally took a lot of hand-holding, and my friends were there for me. And that help me get through the worst parts of it, particularly when my cousin was molesting me. And, you know, I don't mention names because I don't want to get into, you know, that aspect of what I think about his remarriage and the two little girls that were in that woman's family, given my experience. So I don't mention, I just refer to him as cousin in the book. I think that trying to make people understand what it's like to be under a relentless regime that is constantly destroying who you are and trying to reassemble you in a inauthentic personality that will fit their notion of what women should be is one of the most mentally disturbing experiences and soul-killing experiences anyone can have. And to resist that takes the world. I mean, for me, I think that art saved my life. I always refer to it as my sanctuary and my church, because no matter what, I could look at a piece of art or I could read a piece of literature, a poem, whatever, and it stabilized me and gave me roots so that I could somehow draw sustenance from that. I mean, the worst was when you get to the point of suicide. And this was another reason I wrote the book, because I wanted kids that age, teens, 13, 14, 15, 16, to know that they could get through that moment, because it feels absolutely helpless, hopeless, and there's no reason to go on living. What are you living for? And I posed the question in that way. And then I was lucky because I had an intervention from somebody from my earliest years of knowing people from where I grew up and so on. And I was very fortunate that they had been put through the experience and were familiar with it. And actually looking at them and asking, are you happy now, saved me, because I figured if he was happy, and I'd known him all this time and he'd been through it and he assured me that I would get through it, that I would be okay. I wasn't going to let them beat me. And I think that's part of what both Adrian and I share, in not being beaten down and somehow having enough confidence in yourself to say, I'll be damned if these people are going to beat me.
Well, you both have been such wonderful guests, mm-hmm. and we've learned a lot from you about perseverance and authenticity.
Thank you so much for your wisdom, for your strength. And I know you both have touched many lives out there. Thank you so much.
You can find Cassandra's book on Amazon. It's called Erase Her. Remember, just like Cassandra and Adrian, you too can be living proof that through perseverance, through finding a wonderful, wonderful passion and profession, through affecting change. And like Cassandra said, we can't affect change if we hide. Adrian said the same thing. She did not want to hide. So thank you so much for all of your expertise in life and your experiences and your generosity at sharing with us, making our world a better world. Until next month, this is Diana and Sheridan, and we'll see you then.
Good night.
I step out of the ordinary. I can feel my soul ascending. I'm on my way. Can't stop me now. And you can.
Support for Outbeat Radio on KRCB-FM comes from listeners and from Rocky, the free-range chicken, and Rosie, the original organic chicken. Air-chilled, non-GMO, locally raised right here in Sonoma County with no antibiotics ever. More information is available at rockyandrosie.com. You're listening to 104.9 KRCB-FM Roanoke Park and KRCG-FM Windsor.
Sonoma County's NPR station. It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. Beale Street Caravan is next.